Good afternoon, I'm Bruce Berner, and I've been teaching here for the last 2 weeks on subjects about the legal system. Last week we talked about the criminal law, and this week we've been talking about a variety of issues in the civil law, civil cases, accident cases. Tomorrow, which will be my last class, will be a little class on evidence, and particularly we'll address the question, why doesn't the jury get to hear everything? You've probably been curious a lot of times when you read in the paper or hear on the TV that such and such was a fact, but the jury didn't get to know that. And we'll talk a little bit about what's going on when the jury doesn't get to know something and what's driving that. What I'd like to do today is to talk a little bit about legal education and what we do in law school and why. And then just give you a little bit of a sample of it, a kind of a simulated Socratic method session, such as the kind that we might have in first year law class. I'm sure that we've oversold this humiliation business lunch on the kiosk, etc. I'll talk a little bit about the sort of history of humiliation as a tactic in law teaching. And as I said to some of you earlier, is not used nearly so often today as it was in the past or by as many people. But we'll talk a little bit about what's good about it and what's bad about it. What we're going to do primarily today is to simulate what students do in a classroom during their first year of law school. Once they get past the first year, they begin to do a wide variety of other things. They do a good deal more writing. They do a good deal more work independently, only checking in with professors from time to time on some things they're doing. They may become part of a moot court society, which learns to argue cases in which we work on forensic skills. They may take part in a program called mock trial, which is practicing to present a case at the trial level to a jury. When they're in third year, many of them go into clinical programs. Our law school, as almost all law schools, have a legal aid office, and we have some full-time attorneys who work there with the students, and the students actually go into court and actually do real cases under the supervision of attorneys. So it's kind of a nice sort of internship for them. We also have externships, so we place students with judges, both state and federal, with prosecutors, state and federal, with the EPA, with the SEC, depending on what the students' interests are, for 3 hours or 6 hours of credit. So it's not their whole semester, but it's part of their semester's work to get out in the field and get some practical experience. Law students crave practical experience. As far as a law student is concerned, the moment you get into a class and begin to talk theory, they begin to get very nervous and very impatient. They want to know exactly what it is that lawyers do. Tell us the facts. We don't want to know about why the law about wills is this way. We want to know how to draft one. Can you just help us do this? And I always try to sell them on the fact that there's nothing more practical in the world than theory, because how things are done changes every year or every 2 years. But if you understand the overarching theory and what the law is trying to do in a particular area, that'll serve you for a much longer period of time. It's just like the old saying about catching a fish or teaching someone to fish in terms of how that works. But the other thing we do at our law school, and a number of law schools are picking this up, is we require before a student can graduate that the student do 20 hours of pro bono work. That is, go out, find a lawyer, find some way to help people who are unrepresented or underrepresented. Our idea there is to kind of get them before they even graduate thinking about and sensitized to the idea that that their particular profession is one which they ought to think at times of giving away in service to other people. What has surprised me about that, we've been doing that about 5 years, is how little complaining there has been from the law students about this new requirement. law students, you have to understand, will complain about anything, good or bad. Okay. So the fact that they haven't complained about this strikes many of us as remarkable. All right, there are two different ways that we come at things in the first year. We're mostly looking at cases. We deal with statutes a little bit. In fact, we're going to see a statute today. We're mostly dealing with reported cases, and so most of what law students read in the first year are opinions of judges who decided a particular case and then wrote a text explaining why he or she came to the decision that he or she did. And then we unpack that case, try to get into the judge's head, why did the judge decide it this way? And then from a case, if it's a good case, you can extract a principle. Then from the next case, you can extract another principle. And pretty soon you can begin to put the principles together and to form a kind of an idea of what the whole structure looks like. It's not always that easy, because sometimes you might read case one, which will announce a principle, and then the students read case two, and lo and behold, it's the exact same issue decided now just the other way. Maybe it's from another state, and there's we're dealing with 51 jurisdictions in this country, and they don't all have the rule the same way on a given topic. Or maybe the second case is a later case, and so we've learned something in between, or the judge in the second case thinks that the judge in the first case was wrong. For example, when a court writes an opinion, if it's a court, as most appellate courts are, consisting of more than one person, you might get outvoted. But when you get outvoted, you have the right as the judge to write what's called a dissenting opinion. And so right after the other judges are done and they get into the books what they say, then you, as on the dissenting side, get into the books what you say. Well, what good is it? You got outvoted? Well, what good it is it's in the book. And people read it. And maybe a later court reads it. And maybe if your reasoning seems to a later court to be more sound, maybe they'll follow your dissent and overrule the previous case. There were two justices of the Supreme Court of the United States during the 20s and 30s. you'll know the name Oliver Wendell Holmes. Probably not quite so familiar with the name Louis Brandeis. But there were 40-some decisions during the 20s and 30s in which the decision was 7-2. And they were the two. But they were brilliant thinkers and wonderful writers. By the time you get to the 60s, almost all of those cases had now been changed to follow the opinion of the two. So they were just sort of about 30 or 40 years too early, is really all we can tell. They were kind of ahead of the rest of the court at that time. What is the Socratic method? The Socratic method means as many things to people as there are people who try to use it. The broadest interpretation of Socratic teaching is any teaching in which the student is forced to take a very active part. And learning in law school is never sitting and listening to a lecture. It's always coming in being prepared to talk about what the readings were for the day, if necessary, to defend them. And usually in a session in which the professor and the student go one-on-one. Sometimes you'll open it up and get teams going, or you'll get some crossfire going. That's when teachers know they've done a fabulous job. It's when someone over here talks, and before the professor can say anything, someone over there jumps up and says, "No! That's wrong." I actually once had a fist fight. Had two students go at it. That was the best day of teaching I've ever had. Because they cared enough about what they were doing to actually get into a fight over it. Many of you have seen The Paper Chase or other shows and books like 1L, which depict what happens in a law class. And it's probably true that in the 40s and 50s, most law classes looked like that. There was a lot of humiliation. It was an atmosphere of challenge. If you had not done the readings, you just did not show up. It wasn't worth taking the risk of showing up if you hadn't done the readings. I think that has shifted. We still have some who use the Kingsfield method. Frankly, I've always found that whole thing to be a very personal judgment. Some people are very comfortable doing that and are very good at doing that. I'm just not real comfortable with that kind of atmosphere in a classroom. So you come down to a philosophy. Some people think that challenge is the most productive kind of environment and mood in a classroom for learning, and some people think comfort is the most important. I'm sort of a comfort person. Generally speaking, in my classes, I will not call on people who do not volunteer. I will assign them things ahead of time. Each person will get an assignment ahead of time, and so they know they'll have to come in and report on a case and answer questions about it. But in terms of sort of randomly picking on people to respond to things they haven't heard beforehand, I don't do that. Many still do. I think a good law school is one that has all those different things going, so students see different styles of teaching, different styles of learning. My first Socratic experience was my very first day in law school, and the teacher was a guy named Al Meyer. Al Meyer's actually been here before in Holden, lives in California now. He was one of the real masters of the Socratic method. And we went in there the first day, we had a class that was small enough where my name was first in the alphabet. You always pay a price for being first in the alphabet. And so we all came in and we sat down, and we had heard a lot about him. So we were frightened ahead of our time. Everyone had done the reading. And he said, Mr. Berner, and looked around and put my hand up, you know, about as high as I could get it at that point. And he said, good morning. And I said, good morning. And he said, what do you mean by that? Well, the rest of the class is happy that they have names like Zylstra, right? So it's going to be a long time before they get. You can hear the rest of the class sort of rooting for you. Well, I didn't want to let them down, and that's part of what the challenging professor does, is he sort of makes a team out of the class. It is like what Margaret Mead calls the tiger phenomenon. You all draw a little closer together when there's a tiger outside the village threatening it. So I thought a while. I knew that it was not going to pay to be intimidated. And I said, well, you said good morning first. What did you mean by it? It was pretty good. I mean, I have some people behind me go, ooh. To which he said, I'll ask the questions here. And that was kind of my introduction to how the Socratic method was going to work. It's a conversation in which one person has all the control. And that's how Socrates did it. The other person gets to talk. The other person gets to try to persuade Socrates. Socrates will say a lot of things he doesn't even believe. So it's what we usually call playing the devil's advocate, right? Saying things to draw the people out. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of truth and profundity, and I didn't know it at the time when he said, I'll ask the question. I think there's a point in education where a turn is made. Sometimes it's very subtle, but when you first start, when you think of small children in a classroom, the protocol is they ask the questions, the teacher has the answers. At some point in time in the educational process, in good colleges it happens there. Sometimes it may not happen to graduate school if the college isn't particularly good. At some point in time, the questions come from the front of the room, and the expectation is that the answers are in the student body. So when he said, I'll ask the questions, he really meant we had to supply the answers. We were kind of on our own. And I firmly believe that all education is self-education. Teachers can help it along. Teachers can provide a little bit of expertise. But the main thing a teacher can provide, I think, is enthusiasm. I was talking to Jim Farrell last night about teachers we remember growing up, and the teachers that I remember as having the most influence on me were the teachers who were so enthusiastic about what they were teaching, and you could see that they just really loved what they were doing. Even if they were a little inept in getting it across, what got across was the enthusiasm. That spurred me to be interested. If they couldn't teach it to me, I'd go out and learn it on my own. So I think getting people in love with the subject and in love with the idea of learning. We have one wonderful guy I've taught with many years. We were at a faculty meeting, and they said, well, somebody can't be here next year. We'll need this to be taught. None of us had taught it before, and Jack's response was, oh, I'll teach that. I can teach that. What was it? He hadn't even heard what it was. But he was just thrilled that he would get to teach something new, because then he'd have to go learn something new, and he just loved to do that. There's two basic ways that we come at it. One is by looking at a case at a time and trying to draw what we can out of the case. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to call on anybody today unless they raise their hand. If you raise your hand and jump in, I'm not going to be mean, but I'm going to be persistent. How's that? Let's talk about this case. This is a case. This case occurred in the state of New York and was tried in 1939. Gives you a little sense of the feel here. The name of the case is Tedla versus Ellman. And what a law student would get prior to class in the case book, and this is a case out of the torts book, they'll do about 20 pages a night, and so this case would have been a part of it. You can see the case here is only about a page and a half. It starts up here and goes to the middle of here. If you actually went to the reporter, in the reporter system where this case is presented, you'd find it's a good deal longer, but casebook editors edit it down, because a lot of the case will be other issues that have nothing to do with what we're trying to teach with this case in torts. We may find another section of this same case in the civil procedure book, because they're handling different issues with it there. But this is Tedla versus Ellman. Let me give you the basic facts of the case. Mrs. Ellman, we'll call her E. See, these people are pedestrians. See how these are stick people. That's as good as I can draw. And put little arrows there to let you know which way they're walking. They are walking east. Here's your north arrow. Okay. So they are walking east along the side of the road on a beautiful summer evening on Sunday night out on Long Island, east of New York City. Well, New York City's this way. Montauk Point, for those of you familiar with New York, is out this way as the end of Long Island. They are itinerant junk dealers. And they are walking along, the two of them, their brother and sister. Mr. Bacek is deaf, by the way, which does figure into the case in some odd ways. I want you to keep that fact in mind and see when we begin discussing it if it does anything to the facts of the case. This is Mr. Tedla driving east out to Long Island. And his car slides off the road. He is not paying much attention to what he's doing. And he's being careless. He's probably going a little bit too fast. There's no indication that he's been drinking. We don't have anything like that. But he's going a little too fast, not paying much attention. Pretty soon he slides off the road, and he hits Mrs. Ellman and Mr. Bacher. He kills Mr. Bacher, and Mrs. Ellman is hurt severely. Bacher's case, we don't know about. The only case we have is the one that Mrs. Ellman brings. Okay. So there's probably another case. Maybe it was settled. Maybe it was never appealed. See, all the cases in the law books are cases that were appealed. We don't get trials. The students never read in first year about trials. They read appeals, because on appeals, the court deals with legal issues. That's the only thing that you can appeal, is a legal error. At the trial, we're dealing with a lot of facts. Okay. What happened? Was he, you know, how did the car go? What time was it? We have all that. The jury's already told us what happened. The appeal is, what's the legal meaning of what happened? There is no question but that Tedla was at fault here. In fact, Tedla concedes, for purposes of the appeal, that he was negligent. So what's the legal issue? Anybody see anything about that? Have you seen any legal issue? Have you seen anything that Mrs. Elman's doing wrong down here?
She's been walking on the wrong side of the road.
Oh, wrong side. What do you mean, why, how do you know it's the wrong side of the road?
She's been walking against traffic.
Facing the traffic.
Supposed to be walking up here, right? You're supposed to be walking facing the traffic. As a matter of fact, not only is it just sort of a common prudence that you walk facing traffic, in fact, New York had a statute that says when you're a pedestrian, you gotta walk against traffic. You have to walk in such a way that all the traffic is to your right. And the only way you can walk in such a way that all your traffic is to your right is to walk up here. Technically, it's kind of interesting. You could come down here and walk backwards, and then all the traffic would be to your right, but that's not what the statute means. That is, however, what the statute says. Walk in such a way that all the traffic is to your right. What we would simply say is walk facing traffic, right? Now, here's the problem for Mrs. Elman. If it turns out that she was negligent, too, because she's walking on the wrong side of the street, at that point in time, in the late 1930s, the rule was, if this person's negligent and the person who gets hurt is negligent, you get no recovery. That was called the doctrine of contributory negligence. If you, the plaintiff, you, the person who was hurt, if you were in any way at fault, you get nothing. Now, that's not true today. If you were with us earlier in the week, you saw that a lot of times now we deal with what's called comparative negligence, and we'd ask the jury to find out what percentage of the negligence belonged to Mrs. Elman, what percentage of it belonged to Tedla. They would probably assign some fairly low number percentage to Mrs. Elman and give her most of the recovery. But in those days, the rule was you get nothing. You represent, let's say, Mrs. Elman. What kind of arguments can you make as to why she should recover money even though she's walking on the wrong side of the road?
The place where she was walking is not prescribed as a travel lane for the vehicle. She should be assume some degree of safety walking off the road, whether she's going forward or backward. You know, if a person was coming the other way, they would have been totally within the prescription of the law as far as being okay.
Yeah, if she had been walking up here where she was supposed to be walking, and a car had hit her either coming this way or coming this way, then she wouldn't have been negligent and she could have gotten full recovery. But since she's walking down here, that presents a real problem for her because she violates the statute. And there was a rule that said whenever you violate a statute, you're negligent. Because a statute is a rule, and you don't violate those rules.
I guess maybe the distance from the roadway would make a difference.
Yeah, I think so. If you can get Mrs. Elman far enough from the road, then you can begin to say that she's not walking along the road, and that the rule about which side of the road you walk on, and maybe this is what you were driving at too a little bit. Don't know.
Not really.
But if you get far enough from the road, then you say you're outside the statute, because the statute just tells you to walk where to walk when you're walking along the road. So, I mean, if there were 100 yards or 100 feet from there, a sidewalk, you wouldn't have to find some sidewalk up here. The problem is it's a very narrow shoulder of the road that they're walking along, and then there's gullies. And they're probably only 2 or 3 feet off the paved surface of the road when they get hit. There's no curbs. It's not a curbed place at all. They're just walking along the shoulder.
Is the idea here to find arguments for Elman?
That's where we're starting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the condition of the proper side of walking, like, was the shoulder in bad
Yeah, same on each side. Same on each side. Yeah, you may be able to have a make a nice case if for some reason it's not possible to walk on this side of the road. Or if the shoulder's much narrower over here, or it's more dangerous, or there's gullies or cliffs or something on that side of the road. For example, when you walk up from Holden Lake, I don't suggest you just walk opposite traffic. I suggest you walk on the side that doesn't have the 200-foot drop. That's just sort of different, right?
Yeah.
Were they hauling things? You said they were itinerant junk dealers.
Yeah, they're pushing carts. They're pushing carts, but there's nothing is suggested in the case that it was any easier to push the carts there or there. The clues are on the board, by the way.
Well, they're outside New York City.
Yeah, they're outside New York City. Well, New York City's this way.
Is it
a state statute?
Yeah. Well, they're walking in the
street. New York, the city, so important they named it twice, right?
Was there lights on? There's at night.
It's bright. It's only about 6:30, I think, in the evening on Sunday evening in summer.
On the shady side of the road. Shady side of the road.
No foliage of any kind.
Oh, okay.
Are they trying to avoid the sun in their eyes? Is that the right walk?
The sun would be to their back, whichever side of the road they walked on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point, though. Good thinking.
If the sun is in the back, it would not be blinding the driver.
It'd be blinding these drivers.
Yeah.
But not these.
All right.
So that's one thing. Is Mrs. Ellman may have made the, or at least the argument can be made, that these drivers over here are riskier drivers in that they may be in a situation where they can't see. They may be in a situation where they can't see. So the risk of getting hit from these people is less because they can see.
But maybe not at 6:30 in a northern latitude.
But maybe not. And as a matter of fact, they don't even make the argument. We find nothing in the record of the trial that says that was their thinking. Yeah.
I'm going to talk.
You're going to talk.
If they're pushing carts in those vehicles, do they go in the right way?
No, good thought. Maybe we take them outside the class of the statutes, take them outside pedestrians. They're push carts and they have a lot of junk on them, but they're not using the roadway, and so they're not motor vehicles for that purpose. Yeah.
Could it be their business?
We've had a lot of talks about bikes and pedestrians. Why the rule ordinarily is bikes ride with traffic and pedestrians walk against traffic. Think about that sometime. I fervently believe, having studied that once, that there's no reason for that, so far as I can tell. Other than a feeling that a bicycle is just somehow more like a car than it is like a pedestrian. But, I mean, you can't prove it by me. That's not been my experience.
Yeah, but Mr. B was killed, right?
He was killed, yeah.
Yeah, but he was also deaf.
He was deaf, yeah. Well, how does that figure, by the way?
He couldn't hear. You know, she wasn't hit because she probably could jump out.
She was hit.
Oh, she was.
Oh, so they were both hit.
But she wasn't
killed. She was hurt pretty severely. Here's the reason they get it. And then we're going to see whether you think that ought to get them out from under the statute. It's Sunday night. New York City. Long Island is a vacation place. Almost all the traffic is coming this way. This is one car after another. The Sunday night traffic, and the record of the case says that the Sunday night traffic was heavy. Very, very few people going this way. Because all the people who work in New York, you know, they vacation there on the weekend and now they come back here at night. So Mrs. Ellman and Mr. Baycheck, according to Mrs. Ellman, just figured it was safer walking the same way as very light traffic than it was walking against heavy traffic. You buy it?
No.
No.
Uh-oh. Why not?
Well, because if there's that much traffic, first of all, they'd probably be going fairly slowly.
so I'm not so sure that they would be as dangerous. And the whole idea is that they can see you and you can see them. It doesn't change the reasoning behind the statute. And the statute is still a law.
Maybe even especially if you're deaf.
Right. I mean, you'd want to.
Because you
don't. That's your only sense. That
you don't get the benefit of that, the oral sense, yeah.
I mean, that makes any sense.
They can see you either way.
So you don't buy it. I don't buy it. You say it isn't really safer.
No.
You say it's safer to be up here.
I don't think it would be
safer
over there, yes. No.
Everybody agree?
I don't.
Okay, why not? Get it on here.
From personal experience, when we ride, the frequency of the traffic, unless it's slow down, it's stop and go.
But how do you know it's not? Because if there's that many people coming back,
It's not stop and go. It's a lot of cars, but they're flowing freely.
Right. It's just a constant. And there's a lot of, usually there's some agitation coming back from vacation, trying to get back to work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's only an intuitive thought, but the feeling is that when you've got a lot more traffic, it's a lot more dangerous because there's more distractions. People are concentrating on the car ahead of them, and they don't necessarily look to the side. Whereas if there's less traffic, you have...
But you can see them. They're coming at you.
Well, you can see them
this way. No, not if they're behind you. You can't see a car that's coming behind you.
No, I see what you're saying.
I mean, she can't see them, and he can't hear them.
No.
Or, you know, so...
She can hear them.
She can
hear
them.
But could they have gotten out of the way, even if they saw him, if this guy squirted?
Well, maybe so. I mean, who knows?
But that's why I put
the question. We'll never know the answer to that. So.
We do know that they would have avoided being hit if they had been up here. He went there.
He wouldn't have been.
Yeah, we don't know if somebody else would have. There's nothing in the record to suggest anybody else would have.
I mean, they could have, it hadn't even been the way, they could have jumped out of the way.
Well, no, that driver was going there.
No, but he skidded and went here. If they were up here,
but if the situation were completely, if they would have been facing him, which is the intent of them walking against traffic, could they have gotten out of the way?
We don't know.
Well, we know they had to have a little better chance.
But the thing is, even if they had been on the oncoming traffic, if they have carts in front of them, they could have been full of stuff and they could still not have seen it.
Okay. And maybe that's
interesting.
Another argument.
Yeah. Interesting.
You can't see around the car. Well, there's a statute here, and I assume this statute's been argued when it was put into effect. Hmm. All the issues of the very things you're talking about. Secondly, are there any administrative rules that say that the highway department has to put up signs saying you can go on this side if there's a problem on the other side?
Statute. Were they aware of the statute?
Yeah. Well, the ignorance of the law is not an excuse for breaking it.
But statutes are.
I'm with her.
I mean, the law is that you have to, and they broke the law.
Why did Tedula crash?
Tedula.
You gave some.
He was going too fast. He wasn't paying attention. He's not really sure, except he concedes that.
So by going fast and not paying attention, it would seem to me if you're in a crowded traffic condition, you're paying attention, you're not going as fast.
Right, right.
So that would dictate that it's safer to follow the law and be on the other side, even though it's not as busy.
Right.
Or that it is busier. Because, you know, there's speed kills. And that's what happens.
Right. And Tedla's at fault.
Yeah.
No one argues that he's not.
So I don't see Elman, I don't see this being a productive argument for Elman. To say that because there were more cars on the other side, they should be on this side.
Okay, so
I think they should have followed the law and been on the other side. So
okay.
You see the cars coming. Cars are going slower. The drivers are more attentive because they don't, because Tedula is evidence of what happens when you lack attention.
So you think she shouldn't recover any money from that?
I don't think she should recover money because of that argument. Now, there may be some other argument I've missed.
Well, there's a trend here I don't quite agree with. Where we're saying, suppose we had equal traffic going both directions, are we saying that Elman would be less at fault or more at fault if there were a different amount of traffic going the same direction? I mean, I'd much rather side in the sense of being the amount of traffic going this direction was really irrelevant. A car ran off the road. It didn't matter whether it was a single car or one of who's missing traffic.
But from a probability approach,
Probability relevant, a little bit long, this is where we probability?
I'm just saying, if I were looking at which side is safe, yeah. I would say the one side is higher, driving into the sun, and maybe each car has a 1 in 1,000 chance of spinning off the road. Coming the other way, I assume they see a little better, and say they have a 1 in 1,000 chance of spinning it off the road. I've got five cars, so 5 in 1,000 versus maybe 100.
Well, let's give you even more. Let's give you about a 20-to-1 ratio of cars. Let's figure the traffic is 20 times denser here than here. So a car may come along here only every 8 minutes.
No.
Depending on how heavy the traffic is coming back, she could make the argument that it's unsafe to cross the road because the traffic's too heavy to safely get across the road. And so that would be her argument, isn't it?
That's possible if we can get them beginning this walk pretty close to this point. The problem is they've been walking for 8 miles.
But the point is that it's heavy traffic. On vacation.
Huh? No, actually, where they start is 8 miles back the road on this side. Ooh, come out of the side street. They intentionally cross the road to get to this side because that's the light traffic side. And I bet they didn't know of this New York statute, and you're absolutely right. It doesn't matter whether they know or not. Yeah. Do you know what all the statutes are in the state you live in? Yeah. By the way, that's sort of humorous too, but not quite so humorous when you go to another country where the culture may be very different. And there may be a lot of laws there which you just don't know about, which absolutely surprise you. You know, some boys who took marijuana into Turkey got some real surprises, right, about what their reaction is to different things. Let me. What we've heard here for about the last 10 minutes, there are two arguments, and I want to unpack them. One of them is you were disagreeing about whether it's safer to walk on this side of the road. That's a factual question. That's a question we all bring a lot of experience to. I think this side is safer. I actually do think this side is safer. But a lot of people think this side is safer. But the legal question which you raised is, what difference does it make which side is safer if there's a statute telling you which side to walk on? For example, can we each determine when we come to a red light, can we make an individual personal determination about whether it's safer to stop or not at that red light? Is that how statutes work? Oh, here's a suggestion, Bruce. We suggest you stop at red lights. But you know best. And should you decide on this particular day not to stop? About 3 years ago, I was driving in Iowa, and I'm on a road, and I'm coming to an intersection, and you can see literally miles in all directions. There is no one behind me and hasn't been. There is no one coming the other way. I can scan 2 miles in each direction. There's nobody on this side street. And as I come to the intersection, I see there's a stop sign. I stopped. And I'm still not sure why. Of course, legally you have to stop. I can't say, stop signs are for when there's traffic and there's not any traffic, so I go through it. I talked to a sociologist who said, you didn't make a decision. That's driven by what's called strictly habit. You get into a habit. Once you get into a habit, you don't make a judgment to do something each time. The habit just takes over. So there's an interesting question here whether, even if, let's assume for the moment, that the jury finds it's actually safer to walk down here. Under the particular circumstances of this case, it's actually safer to walk down here. Then the question is, do you still have to follow the statute?
Yes.
Well, how were they judged? They were pushing a cart. The cart was going the right direction.
Right? No, the cart's supposed to be up here. The cart's not a vehicle for this
car.
No. No, it's not motorized.
Yes, you still have to follow the statute.
So what you're saying is that if the statute endangers you, if a statute puts you in danger, you're still required by law to follow it. At the extreme end.
I don't recall having said anything. I recall you people having said everything.
Sounds like a professor.
That's the real trick. Can you get through 50 minutes without ever making even one assertion? The students leave the class going,
I think that's a rule of common sense.
Yeah.
Which is what?
Which means that if everybody agrees that it'd be more common sense to do something that would be more safer than the statute, then do that, because that makes more sense to the majority.
Mm-hmm. You'd have to sell to the jury, wouldn't you, though, that it was safer?
Yeah.
That would be a much more extreme situation, I think, than that. To get an idea of what it is.
More extreme.
Expert witnesses.
So you would say there are some cases where you should be excused for violating a statute, where you can show that your reasons for not following the statute are better than the legislature's reasons?
It would have to. I think there probably are if there's seriously bodily harm and it's an extreme situation. Yes, that's probably. I can't think of one.
What if there's construction on the sidewalk side? So that you couldn't.
Yes.
And it's an obstruction.
Right. Absolutely. If you can show that it's impossible to follow the statute, then you're excused. So if we have, if we got erosion and we wiped out this whole section of the road, and this is a cliff down into the sea here, right? Then you're excused because it's not possible to follow the statute.
What about if someone is chasing you with a tire iron and the property next to you has no trespassing? It's obviously a little safer to try to hide in that property. I mean, that's an example where it's not impossible to follow the rule, but you have a good chance you'll get beaten. That's more...
That's a better argument.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's called a defense of privilege. And that particular privilege is driven by what's called necessity. It's very similar to self-defense. You can't hit people. But if they're trying to hit you, then there are certain cases where you can hit people. There were old cases that went this way. This is a public road. The whole public road is washed out. So you reach this point, and you can't cross the road. So they would drive up here and then get back on the road. And then the crank who lived here would sue them for trespass. Right? Because he drove across them. And the rule was, no, they were privileged because it was not possible for them to continue without crossing here. Now, if they did any damage to your property, they'd have to pay for it if they broke things. But if they didn't break anything, the mere fact that they crossed it, the technical trespass is forgiven.
Tire ruts constitute breakage.
Huh?
Do tire ruts constitute breakage?
Yeah, sure. But the damages aren't very large. Yeah.
Was the appeal based on questioning whether the statute was good or not? I mean, did they appeal the statute itself?
The way that the issue gets understood legally or conceptualized legally is this. Under what circumstances can you are you excused from following the literal terms of the statute? So that not following the statute won't make you negligent. See, if the police had come out and caught them walking on the wrong side of the street and gave them the $5 fine, whatever the statute called for, they would have no defense to that. Because now the statute is being applied in a sort of criminal sense. They violate it. The question is, when we're using that statute as a rule of safety, not to prosecute them for violating it, but as a way of saying what they're doing is careless, then the question is, say the statute is one factor in telling us what is careful and what is careless, but it's only one factor. And there may be situations in a particular case which would lead you to think that it's actually safer not to follow the statute. That's the argument that they want to sell to the...
So the spirit of the law versus the letter.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, if it's a criminal case, if we're going to prosecute them for a violation of that statute, we're going to be very rigid in the way that we examine it. But since We're not charging them with violating the statute. We're just trying to see whether or not they're violating the statute makes them careless. Then we have to say carelessness is a function of all the things. Only one of the things is the statute. The other things are the traffic, the sun, everything else. It's very interesting to me that nothing in the briefs or record or anything else makes anything out of the fact that Mr. Bacik was deaf. And I think that's an important fact, because it may very well be that the argument is a weaker argument for Mr. Bacik. Of course, we don't get it in this case because he's not a party to this case. Mrs. Elman is a party to this case. Here's a question. Yeah, sorry. I almost go blind to look up there with the glare coming in, so it's hard to see from down there.
Okay. What I was going to say is I know a good example, if you want it, of common law versus actual law in conflict with each other.
Good, let's try it.
I come from the Washington, D.C. area, where it's common to drive 70 miles an hour around the Beltway. And if you go slower than that, I really believe that you're putting yourself in danger. Whereas the speed limit is 55. However, if you are going anything over 60 or 62, you will be pulled over and fined.
Interesting.
There's a common law that you must drive at least 65 on major highways like the Beltway. The Beltway is a five-lane road that goes all the way around Washington, D.C.
Right.
And other major roads in the Washington, D.C. area. However, if you actually do that in the presence of a police officer and get caught, there's no defense. And the fines are about $350 to $400 if you're caught speeding.
So when we're prosecuting it under the statute, there's a very strict interpretation. You're doing more than the speed limit. But what you're saying, as a matter of fact, is the person who's complying with the statute may be in greater risk than the person who's speeding. I think that's a common perception. I think it is demonstrably false from traffic statistics. But it is certainly deeply felt by many people. I have even tried it with police officers. I was trying to stay up with the flow of the traffic. And he says, and he makes it real clear. You can make more arguments if you want, but you know, the pen's never gonna stop. Here's another one. This is a little piece of sort of common folklore, I call it, or folk law, I call it. They really can't arrest you for speeding unless you do more, and now it depends on what part of the country you're in, more than 5 miles above the limit, more than 8 miles above the limit, more than 10 miles above the limit. You've all heard something like that, right?
Not that they can't, but they won't.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
I've never been stopped doing just under 5 over.
Right. I haven't either. I haven't either.
So I would have to say they won't or don't.
But they could.
Yes, cost
certainly could. Yeah, but there are places. There's a little town on the other side coming up Highway 2.
Gold Bar.
Mm-hmm. If you're 2 over, they're going to nail you.
There's a lot of places in Georgia, too, where if you have out-of-state plates, they're going to nail you. But that's a different kind of situation. Now the question is, why don't they stop?
Margin of error in the equipment.
A lot of times, if it's radar, or even if it's their own speedometer that they're reading off, the margin of error on that may be loose enough that until they get more than 5, you can kind of get them in court each time. Same thing with the breathalyzer; that has a margin of error, and that's why they put those numbers to the point where the margin of error comes down. But my own belief is that we set speed limits in this country a little lower than we really think the right speed is. And so those two things working together even out. Let's take a quick look.
Your bait is here for...
Before I give you how it came out, anybody see anything peculiar about the name of the case?
Would it be the other way?
Why is it that way? Why isn't it Elman versus Tedla?
He lost the first one.
Yes, correct, absolutely. The case was Elman versus Ted. But when, after the case is tried, Mrs. Elman won. When the case goes on appeal, you put the name of the party who takes the appeal first. So if the plaintiff loses and appeals, then the case of the name will look the same. But if the defendant loses and appeals, then we put, in most states, we put the appellant, the person who appeals first, then the appellee. In some states, they don't. In some states, they just carry plaintiff and defendant all the way through. In law school, we just talk about plaintiffs and defendants and third parties. Very often, don't even use names. If it's helpful to understand the case, to use names, because people have read the case, that's fine. I have a very good friend who doesn't like lawyers too much, and who says the reason that they don't use names in law school is they don't want their students to begin to confuse clients with people. Ooh, that's a little rough. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, why don't they put it versus the state? Because if they're appealing the law, it's really they're not going after
at home. In a sense, but the state turns out to be a real bad person to sue because they're immune to almost everything that you can do. Not cities, right? Not plan commissions. We can get sued all the time. But what the court held in this case, Judge Lehman in New York, L-E-H-M-A-N, name familiar to anybody? I guess you have to be from the East and old, like me.
Louis Lehman, wasn't he? No, he was the guy who ran against.
Might also have been a relative, but this Lehman's son was a senator from New York. Remember, United States Senator Lehman. But this is Judge Lehman. His decision in the case is that Mrs. Elman may recover. That even though they violated a statute, that the statute was a safety statute, that the purpose of the statute was to provide safety for pedestrians, then when it could be demonstrated that there was actually more safety to avoid the statute, then you could do so. On the other hand, where a statutory general rule of conduct fixes no definite standard of care which would, under all circumstances, tend to protect life, limb, or property, like stop signs, stop lights, which under all circumstances would be more protective, but merely codifies or supplements a common law rule which has always been subject to limitations and exceptions, then the party may be excused. But here's the key. If the jury finds that under all the circumstances it was reasonable to violate the statute, so the jury has to make its own decision. It really doesn't, it's really not, is it the legislature who makes the call or is it Mrs. Elman that makes the call? It really ends up, in this situation, it's the jury that makes the call, and they should consider the statute, consider its purpose, consider Mrs. Elman's situation, etc. Just a couple other things. I wanted to get to this orange sheet, and I'm willing to stay around. That was the other game we were going to play, is I've got 12 cases here, and another game we play is I asked the students to take these 12 cases, and many of them, they know how they came out because they've read the cases. And I say, I want you to announce a principle which will solve all these cases. And usually when you get an array of cases this big, there is no principle that will satisfy them all. Each of these cases will fall outside the principle a little bit. And all of that, in my mind, comes down to the single most important thing for a law student. And it's what makes them so very, very uncomfortable. They always complain, we don't get any answers from you. And that is, how comfortable are you with ambiguity? If you are comfortable to know that a lot of very important questions don't have the same answer each time, and have layers of ambiguity to them, then you can usually get through law school pretty well. If that's not comfortable for you, we find a lot of people that come out of a natural science background. That's very uncomfortable for them. things have answers, problems have answers, and when they find out that they don't. The other thing I gave you here, we'll talk for 2 minutes and then we'll just open it up and I'll stay here as long as you want. After we do, this is just again part of sort of teaching. After the first chapter we do in the criminal law class is homicide. And it's very tough stuff, and it takes us about 6 weeks, and they go nuts. At the end of the 6 weeks, I give them this chart. And the chart on one sheet of paper collects everything they've studied up to that time, and they always say, what?
Why
didn't you give us this at the beginning? Right? The answer, of course, is, first of all, it wouldn't have had much meaning to you at the beginning, and you wouldn't have been forced to work through it. And then we come to the second chapter, which is burglary. And we go all through that, and then there comes a day where they say, where's the burglary chart? And I say, there ain't no burglary chart. You got to make one. And so that's what Jim Farrell was talking about before. Part of what you have to do is kind of be an example. I tell them, you go home and make a burglary chart, you bring it in, I'll look at it. But then they start to figure out, oh, okay, this was just to show us how to get started, and now it's kind of, we're kind of on our own. But thank you very much. I'm willing to stay as long as you want. We'll talk some more about it.
In tort, only in parentheses, is that unable risk?
Unreasonable.
Unreasonable.
Unreasonable risk, right. I now know how to make these on a really slick computer program, but I continue to do it this way. It just has that kind of rustic look, I think. And it sort of tells the students that you don't need a lot of fancy equipment. You just kind of scribble there and make your own charts as you go. But
can I ask you just one more question on this one? What would have happened if Mr. T hit them trying to avoid a pothole in the road? Would then have been...
Yeah. What, then we would begin to call into question whether Mr. T was negligent too. If, in this case, we concede that he's negligent, and the whole issue is she negligent too?
Yeah.
But in order to win, you have to show that he's negligent. So when you can begin to build in legitimate reasons why his car goes off the road, right? I'll give you one. Driving along, nice sunny day. Is it reasonable to have your car windows open? Mm-hmm. That's not negligent to have your car windows open, right? Bee flies in and stings you in your eye.
God.
A lot of cases like that. A lot of cases like that. Car off the road. Is the driver negligent?
No.
So, potholes are a little tougher, and avoiding the pothole and driving off the road, first of all, it's a bad choice. Hit the pothole or hit the two people, right? You don't want to say, I hit the two people because I wanted to avoid the pothole. But then the other thing that gets in Mr. Tedla's way here is he was going too fast. And speed is negligent in itself because once you see a pothole or something else that you have to avoid, you've left yourself sort of powerless to do it. That's a big part of speed kills. Who said speed kills before? That's a big part of speed kills is not that you're just faster, but that you have less time when you're faced with those choices to make those kind of
things. Could the case maybe have been approached a little bit differently and been decided on proximate cause?
That her actions are not the proximate cause?
Sure.
Possible?
Sure, very relevant.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking another court, maybe another time, would maybe decided on that court issue.
Yeah. Because what?
Probably because, are you a lawyer?
More or less.
probably because post 39, we got more and more into the risk theory of proximate cause, and we begin, probably by the 1940s, we would begin to recognize proximate cause issues to Mrs. Ellman's negligence. At that time, Paul's graph was decided, but a lot of the other stuff, the tank ship case hadn't been decided, so they were more into a direct-indirect cleavage for proximate cause in those days. But today, proximate cause would be a major issue in that. And by the way, proximate cause just means Mrs. Elmer was also negligent, so what? her negligence doesn't tell us really how the accident happened. It's true but irrelevant. Yeah, that's right. That's a very possible basis to decide
is that case. Because if even, let's say she was walking the other way facing him, she probably still would have gotten hit, and this probably still would have been.
Or as this lady said, still may not have had time to get out of the way when they've got all, they're carrying all this, and they're fairly old folks too, Beit Shikanel.
Well, you have a drunk driver driving down their own proper lane,
right,
in the middle of their own lane.
Right.
Not doing anything wrong, but being drunk, of course.
Right.
Well, the other car on the other side comes across suddenly.
Right. Here's one I put on this year's exam, which is sort of right along with what you're talking about. I have a statute, and I give them the statute first. And the statute says, when you're driving on a highway that has two or more lanes going in the same direction, like a divided highway, four-lane highway, you must keep to the right, except to pass, or to make a left-hand turn. Fairly common statute. Almost every statute has it. The state has it, right? So here we go. Both of these lanes are going in this direction. The rest of the highway's over here somewhere, right? So we're going up this way. And one person is negligent in such a way that a guy falls out of his car. And it's now nighttime, and this guy is lying on the road in the left lane. Now along comes our defendant. There's not a car 10 miles in front of him, 10 miles behind him. He hasn't seen a car in an hour. He's the only car on the highway. He's driving in the left lane. But by the way, left lane drivers are one of my real pet peeves. People who will not get right? But there's nobody. Now, he comes along, it's dark. He runs this guy over. Let's call this guy the defendant, or the Delta. He violated the statute. Think we ought to make him pay damages?
He's also overdriving his headlights.
Huh?
He's also overdriving the headlights.
Let's assume that he's not. Let's assume that's true. Overdriving the headlights in some states is also an aspect of negligence here. But let's put this just over a rise where no one would be able to see it. You're absolutely right. Anybody see the problem?
It's not reasonable to assume that a guy's going to be laying in the middle of the road.
Yeah. And if the guy had been lying, in the right lane, huh?
What happened to his buddy? It was driving.
He didn't know he fell out of the car. His buddy swerved. This guy's sleeping in the back seat. The buddy swerves, comes right back on the road. Oh, he's unconscious now. He was sleeping before. He's unconscious now.
It's
a horrible test. Well, the interesting thing about this, and what I wanted the students to see, is that the statute that says keep to the right except to pass doesn't have anything to do with this case.
Yeah.
Because the statute is aimed at risks to other drivers who try to pass you when you're on the right. The statute isn't aimed at people lying in the left lane not getting run over. People are just as likely to be lying in the right lane. In fact, probably a little more likely to be lying, right? So I wanted the students to see that even though there's the statute, it doesn't have anything to do with the way the facts happened.